205. To tell the truth, there are so many varied dangers for the development of a philosopher today that we may well doubt whether this fruit can, in general, still grow ripe. The scope and the fortress-building of the sciences have grown into something monstrous, and with it the probability that the philosopher has already grown tired while he is still learning, or has stopped somewhere and allowed himself to specialize, so that he no longer reaches his full height, that is, high enough for an overview, for looking round, for looking down. Or else he reaches that point too late, when his best time and power are already over, or he's become damaged, coarsened, degenerate, so that his glance, his comprehensive value judgment, means little any more. The very refinement of his intellectual conscience perhaps allows him to hesitate along the way and to delay. He's afraid of being seduced into being a dilettante, a millipede, something with a thousand antennae. He knows too well that a man who has lost respect for himself may no longer give orders as a man of knowledge, may no longer lead. At that point he would have to be willing to become a great actor, a philosophical Cagliostro, and a spiritual Pied Piper, in short, a seducer. In the end it's a question of taste, even if it were not a question of conscience. Moreover, by way of doubling once again the difficulty for the philosopher, it comes to this. He demands from himself a judgment, a yes or no, not about the sciences, but about life and the worth of living. And he learns with reluctance to believe that he has a right or even a duty toward this judgment, and must seek his own path to that right and that belief only through the most extensive, perhaps most disturbing, most destructive experiences, often hesitating, doubting, saying nothing. As a matter of fact, the masses have for a long time mistaken and misidentified the philosopher, whether with a man of science and ideal scholar, or with the religiously elevated, desensitized, unworldly enthusiast drunk on God. If we hear anyone praised at all nowadays on the ground he lives wisely or like a philosopher, that means almost nothing other than prudently and on the sidelines. Wisdom. That seems to the rabble some kind of escape, a means or trick to pull oneself well out of a nasty game. But the real philosopher, as we see it, my friends, lives unphilosophically and unwisely, above all, imprudently, and feels the burden and the duty of 100 attempts and temptations of life. He always puts himself at risk. He plays the wicked game. 206. In comparison with the genius, that is, with a being who either engenders or gives birth, taking both words in their highest sense, the scholar, the average scientific man, always has something of the old maid about him. For, like the old maid, he doesn't understand the two most valuable things men do. In fact, for both scholars and old maids, we concede, as if by way of compensation, that they are respectable. In their cases, we stress respectability, and yet having to make this concession gives us the same sense of irritation. Let's look more closely. What is the scientific man? To begin with, a man who is not a noble type. He has the virtues of a man who is not distinguished, that is, a type of person who is not a ruler, not authoritative, and also not self-sufficient. He has diligence, a patient endorsement of position and rank, equanimity about, and moderation in his abilities and needs. He has an instinct for people like him, and for what people like him require. For example, that bit of independence and green meadows without which there is no peace in work, that demand for honour and acknowledgement, which assumes first and foremost recognition and the ability to be recognised, that sunshine of a good name, that constant stamp of approval of his value and his utility, which is necessary to overcome again and again the inner suspicion at the bottom of the hearts of all dependent men and herd animals. The scholar also has, as stands to reason, the illnesses and bad habits of a non-noble variety. He is full of petty jealousy, and has a lynx eye for the baseness in those natures whose heights are impossible for him to attain. He is trusting, but only as an individual who lets himself go, but does not let himself flow. With a person who is like a great stream, he just stands there all the colder and more enclosed. His eye is then like a smooth, reluctant lake in which there is no longer any ripple of delight or sympathy. The worst and most dangerous thing of which a scholar is capable, he gets from his instinctive sense of the mediocrity of his type, from that Jesuitry of mediocrity, which spontaneously works for the destruction of the uncommon man and seeks to break every arched bow, or, even better, to relax it. That is, to unbend it, with consideration, of course, naturally with a flattering hand, to unbend it with trusting sympathy. That is the essential art of Jesuitry, which has always understood how to introduce itself as a religion of pity.